Erev Tov, everyone. We know that we're just a few days away from Purim, and it's a great schut for the virtual OU Israel Center to once again welcome Moreinu v'Rabbeinu, Harav Zev Leff, to share with us some insights to prepare us for the awesome Yontov of Purim. As we know, the Rabbi Leff will for sure provide interesting insights and inspiration. It is a great schut to once again welcome, so to speak, the Rosh Yeshiva to address us. And without further ado, Harav Zev Leff.
Thank you, Rabbi Shorn. Thank you for the schus of being able to give this shiur. Okay, every holiday, the name of the holiday usually expresses essence of Rosh Hashanah, obviously tells us that it's the beginning of the year. Pesach tells us about the holiday, Pesach, Albote B'nai Israel, and so on, Yom Kippur. Purim, the festival of Lots, seems to be a very incidental part of the whole story of Purim, that Haman decided to determine the day he wanted to destroy us by drawing lots. So why was the name of the holiday given to such an incidental part of the story? In order to understand that and to understand Purim in general, we have to go back and understand Amalek. Haman was a descendant of Amalek, and we'll see that the whole Purim story revolves around the struggle between Amalek and the Jewish people. Now, Amalek was singled out to be the nation that we had to destroy, totally destroy their memory. Anything that was related to Amalek had to be destroyed. They don't seem to have been the worst enemy that we ever had. And many other enemies did much worse to us. So why were Amalek singled out? So you'll probably tell me, simple answer, they were the first. After Kriyas Yamsuf, after the splitting of the Red Sea, the nations of the world were afraid to touch us. We were untouchable. Shomu amim yirgozum, chil ochas yoshe peloshes, ozni vahalu alufei adom, elei moav yuchazim uroan. They trembled from before us. They were afraid of us. So Amalek, who came, and despite the fact that the whole world were afraid, they weren't afraid. The Rashi says it's compared to a very hot, boiling hot bath that everybody was afraid to touch. But Amalek jumped in and they cooled us off in the eyes of the other nations. And they opened the floodgates of all our enemies after that. Reishis Goyim Amalek, they were the first. So because they were the first and they opened the floodgates for everyone else, that's why they are singled out for total annihilation, and that's why they're so bad. But that doesn't really answer the question, because the question can be continued. Why weren't they afraid? Why was the whole world afraid of us and Amalek not? Why, they were just better than everybody else? They were crazy? Why? So let me tell you what I think. I don't have any solid source for this. I have two sources, but it answers so many questions and explains so many things that I'm convinced that it's true. And that's the following. Until Amalek came on the scene, so there were two philosophies prevalent in the world. There were those that believed in God, that God created the world and guides the events of the world. And they were basically the family of Avram Avinu and the people that he influenced. And then there were Avodah Zarah, there were idolaters, people who believed in other powers that governed the world, that ran the world, the wind power and the sun power and so on and so on. Amalek introduced a third philosophy to the world, atheism, belief in nothing. There's no intelligent creator, no intelligent forces that run this world. Although Yorei Elohim, it says by Amalek, which can mean they didn't even fear other gods. Nothing, no one, no power, no intelligence. The world was the result of haphazard coincidences and accidents, and is governed by social, economic, political, haphazard causes and effects. Where is a source to that? So there is a medrash that says that a pasuk in Mishle, Take lets upesi yarin. When you hit the lets, the scoffer, the fool, the pesi will wake up. So the Medrash relates that to Amalek and Yisro. We know that Yisro heard something and came to join the Jewish people. And Rashi says one of the things he heard was Milchemes Amalek. He heard the war with Amalek. So the Medrash uses this pasuk. When you hit the lets, the scoffer, that's Amalek. When they were hit and the war occurred with them, so then the Pesi, the fool, woke up, that's Yisro. So Reb Tzadik Milublin comments on that medrash. He says, a Pesi is someone who believes in everything. Yisro believed in every idolatry, went from one to the other. And a lets, a scoffer, is someone who believes in nothing, not even in idolatry. And that's Amalek. The Sfasemis says similarly, Reishis Goyim Amalek. Amalek denied the Reishis. They were Kofar Be'ikr. They totally denied any deity, unlike the other nations of the world who at least believed in idolatry. And therefore, Amalek were not afraid of us. Because if you were an idol worshiper, and you saw Kriyas Yamsuf, so you would assume that there's some power, may not be God, maybe the sea power, maybe the wind power, that really likes the Jewish people and can do miraculous things to save them, and you'd be afraid of us. You'd be afraid that that power would get you if you started up with us. But if you were an atheist and you saw Kriyas Yamsuf, you would attribute it to blind happenstance, to a coincidence, to an accident. There is no power that guides this world intelligently. Everything is the result of haphazard accidents. So why would you be afraid of the Jewish people? I mean, statistically, lightning doesn't strike in the same place twice. So why would you be afraid that another accident would happen similar to that? So Amalekim, who were the atheists, Kriyas Yamsuf made no impression on them, whereas the other idol worshippers of the world, it scared them. They were afraid that maybe that power that created the splitting of the Red Sea would have them also if they started up with the Jewish people. Now you could ask, I understand that maybe an idol worshipper, a atheist doesn't believe that Kriyas Yamsuf ever happened. But if an atheist saw Kriyas Yamsuf, he saw the sea split, he saw that it saved the Jews and drowned the Egyptians, how could he still remain an atheist and believe that it was a total accident? The answer is, it's possible. There was a Russian scientist named Emmanuel Velikovsky, and he was a very, very smart man. He was a physicist, he was an astronomer, he was an Egyptologist, he was a geologist, and he claimed to have found proof to all the 10 plagues in Egypt, that they actually happened historically. He claimed to have found a papyrus in hieroglyphics that reported the 10 plagues from the Egyptian standpoint. Like it would say, there's blood everywhere, nothing to drink, and so on. And he, being an Egyptologist, claimed that this is what that papyrus said. Others in the scientific community disagreed with him. They said he found somebody's laundry list or something like that. There's a lot of different ways of interpreting hieroglyphics. But he put his career on the line because it was very unpopular to prove the Torah true. But he was ostracized for it. He also claimed that as a geologist, he studied the bed of the Red Sea and determined that it was exposed to the air at some time in its history. So there was a splitting of the Red Sea. As an astronomer, he claimed to have made astronomical calculations that the Earth had stopped spinning on its axis at some point in history around the time of Yoshua ben Nun, and that caused the sun to stand still in the sky for Yoshua. And he also claimed to have found a Chinese legend at the same time in history that reported a long night in China. If the Earth stopped rotating on its axis and there was a long day on this side of the world, there would have been a long night on the other side of the world. And so he believed, he claimed he proved all of these things from Tanakh. You would imagine that a man like that would be a tremendous believer. I mean, he put his career on the line. And he didn't only believe it, he claimed to have proved it all. He was an atheist. So how did he believe all these things happened? He believed them, he proved them. That was his major theory, worlds in collision. He theorized that the planet Venus was not in its fixed orbit at that time in history and came on a collision course with the Earth a few times. And he showed how a close collision with Venus, the gravitational pull of Venus, could have caused all the 10 plagues, and he shows how. And then it also pulled the Red Sea out of its bed and caused Kriyas Yamsuf. And 40 years later, it came so close to the Earth that it stopped the Earth spinning on its axis and caused a long day for Yahushua. Now that's absurd. Not because it couldn't have happened like that. It doesn't make a difference to us how God created these miracles. He could have brought the planet Venus close by and could have caused all these miracles. That's not anything wrong with believing that. But the timing is the miracle, not how it happened. To believe that it all was a coincidence and the planet Venus happened to cause the 10 plagues, and just when the Jews are by the Red Sea, there's Venus again. And just when the Egyptians are coming through, Venus decides to exit stage left. And 40 years later, just to the day that Yoshua needs a long day, not a day before, not a day afterwards, there's Venus again. Venus must have really liked us. But Venus is a senseless piece of rock. So you see that you can be an atheist and believe that Kriyas Yam Suf occurred, but it was the result of a haphazard coincidence and accident. So that is the struggle between Amalek and us. We're called gracious, the beginning, and they're called gracious. It's like a tug of war. You have two teams, one on one end of the rope and one at the other end of the rope. And each one's trying to pull the center towards them. We're on one end of the rope, we believe in God. Amalek is on the other end of the rope, and they believe in nothing. The rest of the world is in the middle, they believe in idolatry. We're trying to pull the world from idolatry to belief in God, and they're trying to pull the world from idolatry to atheism. And this is the Milchama Lashem B'Amalek. This is the struggle with Amalek throughout history. And that's why Chazal tell us Amalek in Gematria, the numerical value of the word Amalek is Safek, doubt. Because Amalek are so strong in their atheism, in their denial of any intelligent power, of any God, that it has to bring doubts into our mind. If you wouldn't know there's another option to Bereshis Bara Elokim, so your belief in God would be very strong. But since you know there are intelligent people in this world that believe that it just happened by accident, a big bang, just coincidentally, so it has to put doubts into our mind. And therefore, whenever Amalek are strong in their atheism, we are weakened in our belief. And when we're strong in our belief, they're weakened in their atheism like a seesaw. Now, Chazal, and therefore there are different ideas what it says, what Amalek did. Asher korcho baderech, they chanced upon you. They didn't believe there's any kind of divine providence. Everything is just chance and happenstance and coincidence. And therefore they cooled us off in the eyes of the nations of the world because they weren't afraid. They considered Kriyas Yamsuf the result of an accident. So what's to be afraid of? And therefore there are two words that crop up constantly, both in the Torah and in the Nevi'im, regarding Amalek. One is the word derech, asher korcha baderech. They got us in the on the path, because that's one big difference between us and Amalek. We believe there's a derech. God created the world for a purpose, and he has a plan, and there's a path. There's a intelligent purpose to this world with a path that reaches towards a goal. By Amalek, there's no derech. Everything is just an accident, a mistake, a happenstance, coincidence. There's no path. Every second is another accident. And another word is machor, tomorrow. Moshe tells Yeshua, go fight Amalek machor, tomorrow. Esther tells Achashverosh, tomorrow I'll do. Everything is machor when it comes to Amalek. Why? Because Amalek has no tomorrow. Since everything is the result of an accident, the accident is only for the here and the now, but there's no tomorrow. If the world has a plan, and there's a God who planned out from creation till the end of time, so there's always a tomorrow. So those two words crop up. Now Chazal tell us that as long as Amalek is in the world, Ein Hashem Shalem, Ve'ein HaKiseh Shalem. God's name is not complete, and his throne is not complete. Based on the following pasuk, the last verse in Parshas Bishalach, Ki yod al keis ka milchama l'ashem ba'amalek midor dor. Rashi learns, God lifted up his hand over his throne and swore that he would wage war with Amalek from generation to generation. This is the struggle with Amalek, as we said, between atheism and belief in God. But the word for kiseh, for God's throne, is missing an aleph. It's contracted to the word case. So God's throne isn't complete as long as this struggle goes on. And God's name, Yud K Vav K, is reduced to only the first two letters, Yud and He, case, ka. So that's what they say. As long as Amalek's influence is in the world, God's throne is not complete, nor is his name complete. There are very deep ideas to that, which I am not privy to. But I'll tell you what I think simply, what it means. God's throne is a symbol of his divine providence, simply because when a king is settled on his throne, you know that he is ruling and guiding, directing the events of his kingdom. But when the Aleph, which represents God, the One, is off the throne, you see an empty throne. You don't see the king on the throne. But maybe the king's dead. Maybe he never was. Who's running the kingdom? You don't know. Maybe it's just anarchy, accidents, coincidences. So as long as Amalek's influence is in the world, it puts doubts in our mind and we don't see God directing the events of the world, and we begin to think that it's just social, economic, political causes that direct the events of the world. So Ein HaKiseh Shalem, when you take the Aleph, you take God off the throne, you're left with case. The word case means hidden, obscure, kisui, mechuseh, it's covered and hidden and obscure. You don't see clearly there's a God who is ruling and directing the events of the world. And Ein Hashem Shalem, God's name isn't complete. The name Yud Ke Vav Ke, Chazal tell us, means Hoya Hove Yiye. God transcends time. He was, he is, he always will be. If you take that name and divide it into two, the first two letters Yud and He, and the last two letters Vav and He. The Yud and He are the building blocks of Hoya and Yihyeh, past and future. All you have to do is take those two letters and repeat them, and you have the word Hoya and the word Yihyeh. The last two letters, Vav-Heh, are the letters that form Hoveh, present. As long as Amalek is in the world, So you can still see God in the past. Look in the Torah. You can see him in the future. Look at the Navi. You know where it's hard to see God? In the present. So the Vav Hey, the last two letters of God's name, are missing. Says the Vilna Gaon. That's only when there is no Beis HaMikdash. When there is no Beis HaMikdash and Amalek are in the world, so their negative influence puts doubts in us and we don't see clearly God directing the world, sitting on his throne, and we don't see in the present God's involvement in the world, only in the past and the future. But when there's a Beis HaMikdash, and the Beis HaMikdash influence did the opposite, it canceled out the negative influence of Amalek and brought back those letters to make God's throne complete and his name complete. What letters are missing? The Aleph from the Kisei and the Vav Hey from Shem Hashem. That's hinted to in the following pasuk, says the Vilna Gaon. Ki bochar Hashem b'tzion. God chose Tzion, the Beis HaMikdash. Iva l'moshav lo. He desired it to be the place that he would dwell. The word Iva is spelled Aleph Vav He. Those are the letters that are missing from God's throne, the Aleph, and the Vav He from God's name. And therefore, those letters are put back into the world when the Beis HaMikdash exists. So that is the beginning of our discussion of Amalek. Now let's take it to the next step. We've established that Amalek were different than all the other nations because they introduced atheism to the world as opposed to idolatry. Which, what's worse, atheist or an idolater? So the Marsha in Sanhedrin says clearly that atheism is worse than idolatry. I'll tell you two reasons why. One reason is that idolatry could be a stepping stone to belief in God. If you believe already that there are intelligent forces that run the world, then it's only one step further to believe that there is one intelligent force that created all of them. We know that Avraham Avinu came to Emuna, came to belief in God, using idolatry as a stepping stone. Yisro, similarly, went through all the idolatries, and after he analyzed them all, he came to the belief that there's one God who created all these powers. But atheism cannot be a stepping stone to belief. You can renounce your atheism and do tshuva and become a believer. But the atheism is not a stepping stone. It's the antithesis of belief in God. The second difference is, can there be an intrinsic moral, ethical system in the world? If you believe that there are intelligent forces that run this world, you're an idolater, you have to believe that those intelligent forces like certain things, and those are what's good, and those intelligent forces don't like certain things, and that's what's bad. So you can believe there is good, bad, right, wrong, moral, immoral in the world. You may distort it completely and think that it's right to burn your children to your idol because that's what the idol wants. But at least in theory, in essence, you believe that there can be an intrinsic morality in the world, right, wrong, good, bad. But if you are an atheist, then there can't be any intrinsic morality in the world because everything's an accident. What could be wrong about stepping on an ant if the ant came about by total accident? It's an accident. What could be wrong with stepping on it? And if there's nothing wrong with stepping on an ant, there can't be anything wrong with stepping on your aunt from Chicago. She's a bigger accident. More accidents went into her than in that little ant. So if the whole world is the result of total accidents, coincidences, happenstance, then there's no purpose. Accidents are purposeless. So there's no purpose to the world, and there can't be any right, wrong, good, bad intrinsically. The most there can be is situational ethics. Don't step on my toes because I'll step on your toes and we won't be able to have a functioning society. So there's nothing intrinsically wrong with stepping on toes, because toes only evolved accidentally. But if we don't have some kind of moral code of how to live together, right, then we won't be able to have a functioning society. That's the most that an atheist can have when it comes to morals and ethics, which leads us to the next difference between atheists and idolaters, how they view the Jewish people. We are very special, important people. Why? We're not the smartest people in the world. The Rambam says that Aristotle reached the highest level of intellect that a human being could reach, short of prophecy. Aristotle was not Jewish. We're not the strongest people in the world. Sumeri wrestlers are much stronger than any Jew that I know. We're not the richest people in the world. Bill Gates is not converted yet. So we're not the smartest. We're not the richest. We're not the strongest. What are we? Why are we special? Torah tells us why we're special. Mi goy gadol, asher lo Elohim krovim elov kashem elokeinu b'chol koreinu elov. What nation is so great that it has a special close relationship with God, that whenever we call on him, he's there? Yes, Jews suffer, but we survive. We've survived the most terrible things, Egypt and Babel and the Spanish Inquisition and the Holocaust, and we're still around at all odds against it. Other nations have disappeared into history, and we're still around. So we must have some close connection with God, that he's always there for us, especially when we call out to him and we daven to him. And the second thing the pasuk says, Umi goy gadol, asher lo chukim u'mishpatim tzadikim, kechol haTorah hazos asher anochi nosei lefneichem hayom. What nation has such a beautiful, perfect Torah that guides every aspect of life? And again, the nations of the world recognize that. The Bible is the book of books, bestseller. They may not think that it applies to them or applies at all anymore or whatever, but the Christians have taken the Torah, tacked on a New Testament, and called it the Holy Bible, Christian Bible. And the Muslims stole most of their Quran from Tanakh. So they recognize the fact that there's a Bible, there's a right, wrong, and the Mela, there can be a Torah that directs what's right, what's wrong. They may not believe in our Torah, they may believe it's obsolete, but they believe in the concept. But if you're an atheist, and there's no right, wrong, good, bad, there can't be a Torah. Torah makes no sense. So an atheist denies the basic principles that make the Jewish people important. You can't get close to a God if there is no God. And you can't have a Torah if there is no intelligent force running this world and everything is only an accident. So the two things that make us important can be accepted, at least in principle, by the idol worshiper, but totally rejected by the Amaleki, by the atheist. I think that is the meaning of the following Gemara. The Gemara says that when Haman offered Ahasuerus 10,000 talents of silver for the rights to destroy the Jewish people, Ahasuerus responded, keep your money and do what you want with the people. So the Gemara says, Lama Dovredome, what can this be compared to? To a person who had a big mound of earth on his field, and another person had a big ditch in his field. And the person with the mound of earth was looking for someone to take it off his field. It was bothering him. He couldn't find anybody to take it away. The person with the ditch was looking for landfill to fill the ditch. One day he passes by the field of the person with the big mound of earth, and he says to him, could you sell me that mound of earth? I could use it to fill up my ditch. The guy says, sell it to you. I've been looking for somebody to take it. Just take it. So too, Ahasuerus, when he was offered money to destroy the Jewish people, he said, what do you mean money? Take them. I've been looking for somebody to get rid of them. But it's interesting. The Gemara compares how Ahasuerus looked at us like a big mound of earth. We were something, and that something bothered him. Ahasuerus is the idolater. He's the one who understands the basis of the importance of the Jewish people, but resents it, jealous of it, afraid of it. She wants to get rid of that something. Haman, the Amaleki, looks at us like a big ditch, like an empty hole in the ground, a nothing. We're not important at all. And he wants to get rid of that ditch and fill it up because that ditch considers itself something, that nothing considers itself something, and he wants to obliterate it. So that's another difference between Amalek and between the idolaters, how they look at the Jewish people. The idol worshiper sees the Jewish people as something. He may resent it, be jealous, hate it, but it's something. He accepts the foundations of what make us important. And the Amaleki, the atheist, sees nothing important about the Jewish people because the two things that make us important don't exist in his lexicon. And therefore, we're nothing in his eyes. And the Maharal says that is Amalek are the antithesis of the Jewish people and want to totally obliterate us. So now one more point about Amalek. Why did Amalek develop this third philosophy in the world? Why were they the first atheists? So let's psychoanalyze Amalek. And usually when you have somebody on a psychoanalyst couch, you go back to their parents. So let's see where Amalek came from. Amalek was the child of Eliphaz ben Esav. Eliphaz was one of Esav's children. And Timnah. Pasuk says, Timnah hoisa pileges le'Eliphaz ben Esav. Timnah was a concubine to Eliphaz ben Esav. And she gave birth to Amalek. Now let's see who these people were. Timnah was a princess. Rashi tells us this, based on the Gemara and Sanhedrin. And she wanted very much to join the Jewish people, to join the household of Avraham Avinu. She was very much impressed with the household of Avraham Avinu and wanted to join. She came when she was a young woman to Avraham Avinu, and he rejected her with both hands. And the Gemara says, not what he should have done. You never reject somebody with both hands. You bring them close with your right hand and push them away with your left hand. But he rejected her completely, probably because he saw the seeds of Amalek within her. She didn't give up. She came up later in life in Yitzchak's time. She asked him to accept her into the family, and he pushed her away with both hands. And then later on, as an older woman, she came in the time of Yaakov, and he pushed her away with both hands. So she said, if I can't get into the front door of this family, I'll come through the back door in the black sheep of the family, because better to be part of this family in the back door in the black sheep than to be a princess in some other family. And she became a concubine to Eliphaz ben Esav, to Esav's son. That is the mother, Timnah. The father, Eliphaz, was a son of Esav, but a little bit more refined than Esav. Esav believed that might makes right. He lived by the sword, survival of the fittest. Whoever's stronger, he's the one who controls the world. Eliphaz was more refined, as his name implies. Eliphaz, my power, my God is gold. He believed that money controls the world, right? Not the sword, but money. The one who has more money is more powerful and can manipulate things more. The control of the world is in the hands of the rich, the money. That's why when he was sent to kill Yaakov by his father, instead of killing him, he took his money away. Because a person without money is considered dead. In any case, if your mother was rejected by the Jewish people, and your father believed that it was money and power that ruled the world, so the perfect philosophy to develop would be atheism. Why? Because what is the knee-jerk reaction to rejection? Sour grapes. If he rejected me, then he's nobody. And if he's nobody, then nobody rejected me. So if your mother was rejected by the Jewish people, you would want to have a philosophy that made nothing of the Jewish people. That's atheism. And if your father believed that money and power ran the world, that's also atheism. There's no intelligent spiritual power that runs the world. Might makes right, survival of the fittest. That's what the evolutionist believes in. So if your father believed that money ran the world and your mother was rejected by the Jewish people, the ideal philosophy to have is the philosophy of atheism. And now, whenever the Jewish people are weak in their emuna, in their belief in God, we become vulnerable to Amalek. What happened the first time that Amalek came? When we questioned, when we needed water, we were thirsty in the desert, and there was no water source. And we questioned, Hayesh Hashem b'kirbeinu imayin, is God here? Is he going to provide us with water in the desert? And the commentaries explained, what was their doubt? They saw Kriyas Yamsuf, they saw Eser Makos. They had a pillar of fire at night and a cloud in the daytime leading them. How could they have a doubt whether God was with them? They answer, they thought maybe God only gets involved when you need miracles. God comes in for the spectaculars. But the regular, everyday, giving water and food, that God put the world on a Shabbos clock called nature, and he doesn't get involved. So is God with us even for these things of nature, or maybe only for supernatural things? When we're not sure that God is involved in nature, then we are vulnerable to Amalek, who doesn't believe that God even does miracles. Nothing. And therefore, Purim time, and now we will apply everything we said to the whole story of Purim. Purim time, the Jewish people also doubted whether God was involved with them. They were in Golus, Bavel. They were, the Beis HaMikdash had been destroyed. The people had been thrown out of Eretz Yisrael. And many of them said, God divorced us. And they came to the prophet and said, basically, God abandoned us. He threw us out. He divorced us. And therefore, we are no longer beholden to him. And he is no longer involved in our destiny, in our life. And the Navi told them it's not true. Ezra Sefer Krisus, where is your document of divorce? God never divorced you. He never abandoned you, as it says in the Torah. Afgam zos biosum beretz oyveyam, even when we're in the land of our enemies and we're in Gaulis and in exile. Lo ma'astim, it's not because I hate you. Lo ga'altim, it's not because I abominate you. L'chalosim, I don't want to destroy you. L'hofer brisi tam, I don't want to abrogate my covenant with you. Ki ani Hashem, I'm your God. I'm always there for you. But you need to be punished. You need to awaken and do tshuva so you can come back to Eretz Yisrael and finally build another Beis HaMikdash. So, but the Jewish people thought, no, God's no longer involved. Because of that, they committed two sins, which we'll see have a connection one with the other. This is what the rabbis tell us precipitated the them being vulnerable to the decree of Haman. The first sin was Polchul Tzelem Shal Nebuchadnezzar. They bowed down to the idol that Nebuchadnezzar set up that everybody has to bow to. And except for Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, everybody bowed. All the Jews bowed. Why? Because they made the following calculation. If we bow to this idol, we will be good in the good graces of Nebuchadnezzar and not in the good graces of God. If we don't bow, we'll be in the good graces of God, but not in the good graces of Nebuchadnezzar. God has abandoned us. So who is significant? Nebuchadnezzar. He's a powerful one who runs the world. So better to be in his good graces than God's, and they bowed to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar. When you think that God abandoned you, then you have no more importance, because your importance as a Jew is the fact that you have a special relationship with God, and you have a Torah that he gave you that guides every aspect of your life. And you don't believe in that anymore. You think that God abandoned you, so you have no importance. That led to the second sin. The second sin was Nehenu Misudas Achashverosh. Not that they went to the party of Ahasuerus. They had to. According to many opinions and according to the Midrashim, Mordechai was at the party. He was a waiter. You had to go to the party. If Ahasuerus invited you to a party, you didn't send back the RSVP, "I'm sorry, I have a prior commitment." Vashti tried that. She refused an invitation of Ahasuerus and she lost her head. So it's pikuach nefesh, right? You don't put your life in danger by refusing to attend Ahasuerus' party. They had to go. The problem wasn't that they went to the party. The problem was that they enjoyed it. What was the party celebrating? The downfall of the Jewish people. Ahasuerus made a calculation that the 70 years that Yirmiyahu had predicted that Golus Bavel would last, and then the Jews would be redeemed, was over. And they weren't redeemed. So he celebrated the fact that the Jewish people will never be redeemed and never taken out of Persia. And he took out the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash and the clothing of the Kohanim and celebrated the downfall of the Jewish people. And here were Jews who were forced to be at that party, and they enjoyed it. How do you enjoy a party that's celebrating your downfall? The answer is if you have no self-esteem and no self-respect as a Jew, because you think that God abandoned you, and therefore what makes us important, our relationship with God and our Torah, don't exist anymore. So you have no self-esteem and no self-respect. So what gives you importance? Rubbing shoulders with powerful people, because you believe that they're the ones in control. So I got to go to the party of Ahasuerus and rub shoulders with powerful people. That gives me importance. So they enjoyed the party, even though it was celebrating their downfall. If you don't think that can be, I remember a few years ago, the Oslo Accords, Arafat, Yimach Shemo V'Zichro, he came to Israel, and there were Knesset members, mostly leftists, atheists, who were falling over each other to shake his hand. Who would want to touch such a dirtbag? But they couldn't wait to shake his hand because they had no importance of being Jews. Didn't believe in anything. So what's their importance? Shaking hands with powerful people like Arafat. So you can enjoy a party that's celebrating the downfall of the Jewish people if you have no self-esteem and no self-respect because you think that God abandoned you. So because of these two sins, which were related one to the other, bowing down to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar, which showed that they felt that God had abandoned them, and Nebuchadnezzar was more relevant than God, and then losing their self-importance and enjoying the party of Ahasuerus celebrating their downfall, made us vulnerable to Haman, Amalek, in the guise of Haman. And that's why it says that Haman really was only upset with one Jew. Mordechai wouldn't bow to him. But the pasuk says, "Vayives be'enav," it was disdaining to him to deal with one Jew, l'shloach yod b'Mordechai levado, to deal with one Jew. The Amaleki considers the Jews a hole in the ground, nothing important. And therefore, if you have a cockroach, you don't deal with one cockroach, you kill the whole nest. It's beneath you to start fighting with one cockroach. Get rid of all of them. It's beneath Haman to deal with one Jew. Jews are unimportant, totally worthless. So you don't kill one, you get rid of all of them. That's why he made his decree to annihilate and to totally obliterate the Jewish people. And how did he decide to do that? By drawing lots. He pil pur hu agoro. He drew a pur, which is a goro, which is a lot. That's the way it's normally translated. Now, why didn't it just say he pil goro? He drew a lottery. Why pur hu agoro? Why did he use two words to describe what Haman did? So some say that pur is a Persian word for lottery. And the Megillah, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah who wrote the Megillah, wanted to preserve how Haman called it. So they wrote the word pur, but we're not Persian. So how do we know what poor means? So it had to translate it. Hu hagoro. In Hebrew, poor is a goro, is a lottery. Okay, that could be. But why would it need to translate it twice? In the third parak it says that, and again in the ninth parak it says, Vehi pil poor hu hagoro. How feeble-minded the Anshik Nesagdola think we were that we wouldn't remember what poor was from the third parak to the ninth parak. Why'd you have to translate it again? And even more of a question, the Radak says that poor is a Hebrew word, comes from the Lashon of Perurim, crumbs, small things that you throw when you throw a lottery. So if it's a Hebrew word, why was it necessary to translate it? And if it was an archaic Hebrew word, and the word goral was more used in the vernacular, so then don't tell me poor at all. Tell me who appeal, goral. And therefore I think it's not a translation. It's a slogan. He peeled poor. Haman drew a lot. Hu hagoral. And he said, that is your destiny. You think that there's a God who runs this world. You think that there's a path. There's a tomorrow. There's no path. There's no tomorrow. Everything is just an accident. And therefore, who's ever powerful runs the world. And I'm powerful and rich. And therefore, I don't have to destroy you now. I can just draw lots, leave you up to chance and coincidence. Poor, who I go roll. Your destiny is only the draw of a lot. No one's going to save you. And therefore, I don't have to kill you now. I can wait 11 months. Whenever the time comes up by accident, by coincidence. That was Haman's slogan. And it's interesting. The word who is what letters? Hey, Vav, Aleph. Turn it backwards. Aleph, Vav, Hey. Those are the letters that are missing from God's throne, the Aleph and the Vav, Hey from God's name. By saying that, he wanted to take those letters and uproot them and turn them upside down, backwards, take them out of the world to take God off the throne and to reduce God from the present into the past and only the future, because you can't see him in the present. Those are the letters that Amalek takes out of the world. And therefore, after Haman made his decree, and he said his slogan, poor hu agoro, your destiny is only the cast of a lot, totally up to accident, happenstance, coincidence. You're in the power of the strong and the mighty who rule this world, survival of the fittest. The Jewish people began to do tshuva. As Chazal say, Godol hasoras tabas mimemches neviyim v'shiva neviyos. More than 48 prophets could do to bring us to repent, and 7 prophetesses. When Ahasuerus took his ring off and gave it to Haman and gave him control over the Jewish people, it had more of an effect on them, and they began to rethink, maybe God didn't abandon us. Maybe we better daven to him. Maybe we better do tshuva and come to realize that God is still involved with us. He's never abandoned us. He's never not in the picture. And therefore it says that they had tzom, they started to fast and repent, Ubechi, and they cried out to God and Davin, God save us. And Mispaid, and they started to eulogize. And the Svarim asked, who were they eulogizing? Nobody was killed yet. The decree wasn't for another 11 months. This was in Nisan, and the decree was for an Adar, Purim time. So who were they eulogizing? I think what it means is, once you believe that God didn't abandon you, and he's still relevant, then we're pretty important people with that relationship with God. And they started to eulogize themselves. Wouldn't it be a shame if important people like us were annihilated? That was the misbate, because these two things always go together. The more you believe that God is involved in the world and in your affairs, the more important the Jewish people are. So, God sent Mordechai and Esther, who atoned for the two sins that the Jews committed. Mordechai atoned for the sin that they bowed to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar by not bowing to Haman. Haman was strong and powerful and considered himself an idol himself, and Mordechai wouldn't bow, because Mordechai made the opposite calculation that the Jews made when they bowed to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar. If I bow to Haman, Haman will be happy with me, but God won't. And if I don't bow, God will be happy and Haman won't. Who's more relevant? God, not Haman. So he atoned for the sin of bowing to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar, and Esther atoned for the sin of them enjoying the party of Ahasuerus that celebrated their downfall for lack of self-esteem and self-respect as Jews, and feeling that their importance comes from rubbing shoulders with powerful people. Esther did more than rub shoulders with Ahasuerus. She was his wife, and she didn't consider that anything of any importance. She considered living with Ahasuerus as kasher avadati avadati. It's my destruction. What did she consider important? Being a Jewish woman. That was her importance. And that was the antithesis of the Jews who enjoyed the party of Ahasuerus celebrating their downfall. And that is the message of Purim. The message of Purim is two things. They go together. God never abandons us. And even when it appears to be the case, he's in the background. He hasn't left us. He's not abandoned us. He's chastising us. But he's there constantly, never abandons us. And if that's the case, then we are very, very important people. And therefore, the fact that Haman wanted to destroy us by casting lots was not an incidental part of the story. It was the essence of the story. Haman believes in lots, accident, coincidence, total chance, no guidance, no God who's guiding the events of the world. And his poor became our Purim, because even what appears to be accidental and coincidental, all of the things of the Megillah appear to be coincidental, but if you put them all together, it's too much of a coincidence. Obviously, there's a hand that is guiding everything hidden, but it's there. That is the lesson of Purim. God is always there. He never abandons us. Sometimes he's behind the scenes. And therefore, we are always extremely important, important people. And that's reflected in the Megillah. Megillas Esther, they say, is Megala HaHester. It uncovers the hidden hand of God that is always there guiding things. It says that Esther had a nickname. She was called Ayeles HaShachar, the dawn. And the Gemara says, why was Esther referred to as the dawn? Because just like the dawn is the end of night, Esther was the last miracle in history that was recorded in Tanakh. So it was the end of the period of miracles recorded in Tanakh. Rabbi Yonasan Apshitz asked the following obvious question. Day is always a symbol of good, and night is a symbol of bad. So if you want to symbolize the end of the period of miracles recorded in Tanakh, I would say it should be the end of day, not the end of night. So why is she called dawn? She should have been called Ben Ashmashas, sunset, not dawn. He says, no, what it means is the following. He says, if a person is in the midst of a storm at night, pitch black, no artificial lighting, he's afraid to move out of his place. He may fall into a ditch. He may fall over, trip over something. He doesn't know what's in front of him. He's stationary. And all of a sudden, there's a lightning bolt. And the lightning bolt illuminates a few yards ahead of him. He's able to walk now for the next few yards. And then he's stuck again. It's dark. He doesn't know what's ahead of him. Another lightning bolt. He can go another few yards. And this goes all night. Every time there's a lightning bolt, he can proceed. When does he not need the lightning bolts anymore? When the dawn comes, when it gets light. He doesn't need the lightning bolts. Now he can see very nice what's ahead of him. So too, Rabbi Yonasan Abishan said, from the time he left Egypt until the time of Esther, every few hundred years, we needed a miracle, a lightning bolt, to remind us that God is there and to let us continue on for another few hundred years, and another lightning bolt, and another one, recording in Tanakh. But Esther showed that the dawn came. You don't need the lightning bolts anymore with the miracles, because you see, even when there are no open miracles, God's there. He's behind the scenes. He's always there. Now you don't need those open miracles anymore. You don't need the lightning bolts. Dawn has come. So the Megillah shows us that the events, if you see them individually, they could be a coincidence. But there are too many coincidences. It must be that there's a hand guiding all of this. And it's interesting. The Gemara says that the Megillah is called Divrei Shalom Ve'emes. It's words of shalom. It makes peace amongst the Jews because we always consider each other important now. So we're friendly with each other. We're important as Jews. And emes, and it shows the emes, that God is always there. But the Gemara learns out from the word emes that the Megillah needs sirtut. It needs to be lined. The parchment of the Megillah has to be lined like the parchment of a Torah, like the Amita Shel Torah. Why is that called the emes, the truth of Torah, the fact that it's lined? Before you write a Sefer Torah, you have to indent the parchment with a blunt instrument. You don't write it with ink. Lines. And the letters are written with the top of the letter on those lines. That's called sirtut. Why is that called the emes of Torah? And why does the Megillah need that too? We normally think that things occur and then they're recorded in the Torah because they occurred. But that's not true. There's an almost invisible line. There's a derech. There's a path. There's a plan. And it's almost invisible. And the events line up on that line. There's divine providence. There's a God who is orchestrating what should happen in this world. It's not Hefker. It's not happenstance and coincidence and accident. There's a hand that's guiding everything. That's that line that's in the parchment before anything is written, before anything is recorded. The events line up on that line, on that derech. That's Amita Shel Torah, and that's what the Megillah tells me. So therefore, those are the mitzvahs of Purim. The reading of the Megillah represents the first lesson of Purim. God is always there. He may be behind the scenes, but he never abandons you. And then comes the second mitzvah of Purim, eating and drinking. Have a nice party. Why? Because if you consider yourself important, then you want to promote your existence. What is the simplest way of promoting your existence? Eat and drink. They say that people who have anorexia have a secret or subconscious death wish. They don't feel that they deserve to exist. So they want to disappear and starve themselves. So the opposite would also be true. Someone who considers himself important and wants to continue to exist eats. Okay, there's got to be some balance over there. But eating and drinking shows I consider myself important. I want to preserve myself and promote my existence. But I'm not important because I'm me. Not my existence is important only, but every other Jew. So give another Jew something to eat and drink. That is mitzvah mishloach manos. We're important because intrinsically we're Jews. So give the Evyon, who has nothing except that he's a Jew, give him not tzedakah. Don't give him charity. Give him a present. Presents you give to important people. Those are the mitzvahs of Purim, representing both of these ideas which are interrelated. God is always there, and we are all very important. Also, it's another reason why they instituted giving to the poor on Purim, even though giving to the poor is a mitzvah all the time of tzedakah, but they were afraid that when people become so clear that God is always there, that they maybe will abandon the poor people and say, well, if God controls the world, let him take care of the poor people. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter says, a person has to be a a maimon, a believer for himself, and an apikoros for his friend. If you lose your job, you have to have emuna and be talking, God will take care. But if your friend comes to you and says, I lost my job, I don't know where my next meal is coming, you don't tell him, have emuna, be talking, God will take care. God wants you to take care of him. So there was a danger that on Purim, people will forget about the poor and leave it up into God's hands, since we so much believe that God controls the world. So they instituted giving to the poor to remember that even though God controls the world, he wants you to help that poor person in order that you should get a merit. And that is the simcha of Purim. Ein simcha katoras asveikas, when there's no doubts and you're sure that God is there for you and you're sure how important you are. There's no greater joy than that. And that is what it says in Shoshanas Yaakov. Shoshanas Yaakov is a poetic way of saying the Jews of Shushan, but it's deeper than that. Chazal tells us that when we're in exile, we're like a Shoshana bin Achochim. We're like a rose or a lily amongst the thorns. And even when we're in Golus and we're like that lily amongst the thorns, and we're out of Eretz Yisrael and the Beis Hamikdash has been destroyed and we're on the level of Yaakov, not Yisrael. We're like Yaakov holding on to the heel of the nations of the world. Still, we have a reason, Tzohal of a Samecha, we have a reason to rejoice. Why? Two reasons. One is, Shuasam HaYisol HaNetzach, because we recognize that God ultimately will redeem us. There's a plan for this world, and it will end with our redemption with Mashiach. But, Tikvasam B'chol Dor V'Dor, even though we don't see that in every generation, and there are generations when we see the Jews suffer, but we have hope, because we know that God never abandons us. He's always there behind the scenes. There's a reason why we have to suffer. That's the first lesson of Purim. And then Lahodia, that teaches me the second lesson. Shekol kovecha lo yevoshu, all those that have that hope and realize that God never abandons us. We have nothing to be embarrassed about. We should be proud of ourselves. We have nothing to be embarrassed. Lo yikolmu lo netzach kol achosim boch. And not only that, but we have not, even though we can be insulted by others, that won't be forever. Eventually, the nations of the world will realize who we are too. So, lo yikolmu lo netzach, we may be in the short term insulted, but not on the long term. And therefore, if there's a God who's always there or never abandons us, and we're very important, then there's good in this world, and we have to support it. And there's bad in this world, and we have to destroy it. Arur Haman, Baruch Mordechai, Arura Zeresh, Brucha Esther. And even those people who seem to be just incidental, Gam Harvona, Zohar Latov, give credit to those who support good and destroy those that support evil in this world. That is, those are the mitzvahs of Purim, and that is the message of the Shoshanas Yaakov. And that's why end with the icing and cherry on the top. Our regular Purim, not the Purim of Yerushalayim, Shushan Purim, can only fall on 4 days of the week according to our fixed calendar. The first day of Purim, Yud Daled Adar, can never fall on Shabbos, can never fall on Monday, and can never fall on Wednesday. Those days are never the days of Purim. First day of Purim. So what days are left? Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. What letters of the Aleph Beis represent those days of the week? Sunday is Aleph, Friday is Vav, Thursday is Hay. Aren't those letters familiar to you? Those are the letters that are missing from God's throne and God's name. The Aleph, the Vav, and the hay. There's only one problem. There's one more day, Tuesday. What's Tuesday? Gimel. Put the gimel in front of the Aleph Vav hay. What word do you get? Gaava. Pride. This is the pride of the Jewish people. That God's throne is complete and his name is complete, the Aleph Vav and hay. And that is the pride of the Jewish people, that we have a special relationship to that God who's always there. That's the message of Purim. Gimel, Aleph, Vav, and Hey. And interestingly, if you add up those days of the week, 3, 1, 6, and 5, it equals 15, which hints to the next day of Purim, the 15th day of Adar of Shushan Purim. And Purim was established with a tomorrow, because that's how we fight Amalek, tomorrow. They have no tomorrow. We have a tomorrow because we have a God who has a plan for the world, and there's always a tomorrow reaching towards that plan. So that's why the name Purim is not an incidental idea. That is the crux of what Purim is all about. What are the lots? What is the destiny of the Jewish people? Is it merely chance, coincidence, like Haman thought? Or no, but even the chance and coincidence is all part of God's plan. It's all being determined and guided by God's plan, and his Pur became our Purim, and that is the gaiva, that's the pride of the Jewish people, that God's throne is complete and his name is complete. And just like Purim was the preface to the return to Eretz Israel and the building of the second Beis HaMikdash, Purim is the preface to Pesach, to the redemption. And Pesach is a symbol of the final, the redemption. Ki metzeis chomi eretz Mitzrayim arenu niflos. Like God took us out of Egypt, he will redeem us with the coming of Mashiach and the building of the third Beis HaMikdash and the utter destruction of Amalek and all of atheism forever, and bringing the entire world to a belief in the Rabbanu Shel Olam, the Vias Goel Tzedek Meherav Yomeinu.